Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. I'm really delighted about this hour. The British readers have their agony aunts. Americans love advice columns. We have forever outsourced our introspection to Ann Landers, Dear Abby, Miss Manners, even back in the colonial day, Ben Franklin. Now, a new generation of kibitzers carries that torch. Dan Savage, Dear Sugars, and one of my guests, Meredith Goldstein. And it's moved from newsprint to the web to our earbuds. Yet beleaguered in Baltimore has the same hopes and fears as ever. This hour, On Point, the rich history and current challenges of advice columnists. You can join us on air or online. I hope you will. Do you still religiously read Carolyn Hacks? Or are you now taking your queries to sites like Quora? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me in the studio is advice columnist Meredith Goldstein. She's the author of the Boston Globe's Love Letters columns, and she's just out with a new book called Can't Help Myself, Lessons and Confessions from a Modern Advice Columnist. You can find an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Meredith Goldstein, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from New York is Jessica Weisberg. She's an author, magazine writer, and podcast producer. Her new book is titled Asking for a Friend, Three Centuries of Advice on Life, Love, Money, and Other Burning Questions from a Nation Obsessed. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jessica Weisberg, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thanks so much for having me.
Guys, first I want to say just congratulations not just on the books, but on the titles. I love them. They're great. Let's start at the top. Meredith, you're here right here with me in Boston. What makes a good advice columnist?
Oh, wow. That's a complicated question because there are many, and each one has a very different personality. I mean, for me, I like to be the advice columnist who would say to your face what I say in writing, which, by the way, is a difficult thing to pull off. Other advice columnists, it's more about the entertainment of what they write. So, I think finding your own voice is a big part of it. But for me, it's the ability to help someone without turning them off to you. You know what I mean? Like, help someone without judging too much.
Without judging too much, although you're there to render judgment,
you are there to render judgment, right? But we also know that in real life, we don't just do what people tell us to do. We might ask a friend for advice and hear advice, but we don't just go break up with that guy because we're told to. We have to get advice in just the right kind of productive way. It's a difficult thing to pull off.
Jessica, you're not an advice columnist yourself. Before we get to the meat of your book, as a reader, as a human on this earth, what do you look for in an advice columnist?
I think I look for people who are honest, like Meredith said, and who I feel like are telling me, giving it to me straight. I also think I look for people who offer some vulnerability themselves and show to the audience that they're fallible too and they need advice and need some guidance as well.
So you want them to show a little skin in the game, I guess. Meredith, you wrote, you know, in print about your breakup,
mm-hmm.
You know, I think at one point you said that, you know, you got the assignment and you're riding high. And by the time you actually started, you had a breakup.
Yes, the timing was not fantastic. I had asked the Globe, you know, I really felt like it needed a Boston advice column. Little did I know it would become national pretty quickly. But when I asked them, I was a happy person. When I started the column, when it got green lit, I was a dumped person. So I was very concerned about, you know, can I be optimistic? Can I give people productive advice when, in fact, I am in bed watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer all the time and crying about my ex? And that was a real challenge. But I think in some ways it made me so much more empathetic, and I was able to, you know, disclose some of that to readers. Not too much, but just a little bit, you know, letting them know I'm doing this with them.
You say not too much, but you also wrote about your mother's illness.
I did.
You wrote about some of the most painful things I imagine one can explore with friends, much less with the public.
Yeah. I mean, I really kept a lot of it to myself for a long time. I kept thinking, do readers really want to know about me? This is really about them. But at some point, I had to say, look, you know, I'm dealing with my own stuff here. And it was after I had lost my mother that I went online and said, oh, my gosh, I have been, you know, caretaking for a parent this whole time. And mm-hmm. now I have lost her. what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to let ex-boyfriends comfort me? They keep showing up. How am I supposed to date? How am I? And it was amazing to me that readers in the comments section just gave me all the best advice.
Did that serve you or them better?
I think it served all of us. Uh-huh. I mean, I think it probably was, you know, super helpful for them to feel like, oh, I'm helping her now. But I think we all learned a lot from each other. People's stories of grief, of breakups, you know, it does sort of feel like we could all be in some support group in one room giving each other a hug.
Jessica, you decided to delve back into the archives. What made you start off on that trek?
Well, I thought that, you know, advice giving has a really long tradition in America. And I thought that it deserved a sort of literary history to look at the origins of this tradition. I sort of came to the subject because a number of years ago, I was writing book reviews at the back of the magazine of The New Yorker, and Cheryl Strayed's book was coming out, and I offered to review it. And the editor of that section, a man I really admire, sort of said, well, we're not going to be reviewing that book. It's an advice book. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Like, these are books that are very popular and have a huge impact on Americans. Why aren't they being treated seriously? And I wrote an article for the New Yorker's website at that time about advice columnists. And then the idea just kept staying, it lingered, and it stayed with me. And I sort of decided to jump into a book a few years ago.
So before we get into what you found on that search, we do have a clip from Dear Sugar. The advice columnist, the column was originally put out by the online literary magazine The Rumpus. It has a cult-like following. First, essayist Steve Almond answered reader questions, and then Cheryl Strayed, as you mentioned, took over. They now answer audience questions together on their podcast. Here's a 2016 episode of Dear Sugars where they talk about readers who asked about whether they should stay or leave their relationships. In this clip, Cheryl responds, and she gives advice by talking about her own experience leaving her first husband.
I had to break my own heart. That's, again, you have to be brave enough to break your own heart is something I wrote and something I learned the hard way. Mm-hmm. Because I kept waiting for there to be a sort of outside reason to right. leave my husband. Oh, he was abusive, or he cheated on me, or he did this or that or the other thing. And honestly, I think that that's ultimately why I cheated on my first husband, which I really regret.
Meredith Goldstein, what do you hear when you hear her giving that answer?
Oh, I love her. That's what I hear. But, you know, I think I hear empathy, and, you know, I think it's just constantly looking for meaning. You know, why do we do what we do? And I'm not surprised that Jessica was met with resistance when she really wanted to give this type of book coverage, because I think people in some ways can be embarrassed or ashamed or write it off. But, you know, when I was pitching the column to The Globe, it was then Marty Baron running the paper of The Washington Post. And I just kept telling him, you know, this is what we look back on as a time capsule of our lives, how we dated, how we divorced, how we married. And I think, you know, all of those editors really got it in that moment. You know, it's not just about news stories and sports stories. It's also looking back at advice columns to see how we lived.
So do I have to give Marty Baron props not only for Spotlight, not only for bird-dogging the Trump administration's and ethics questions, but for his insights on the human soul as well?
He also greenlit an advice column at a time when he had to cut so many other resources and was really open to the idea. So I'm very grateful to him.
We've got a call from Springfield, Illinois, from Sarah that actually raises, I think, an important question. Sarah, go ahead.
Hi, David. I was just wondering, as a person who's never really read advice columns, though having heard of a lot about them from other people who do, what exactly is the expertise of, like, advice columnists? Because I know if I have a question about, like, my health, I'll go to a doctor to ask that question. Or if I have a question about finances, I'll go to a financial advisor. So I'm wondering, like, what the expertise is that would make people good advice columnists, and if they have specific categories for their advice columns so that they stay within their expertise.
Meredith.
Well, hilariously, whenever anyone asks me what qualifies you to do this, I like to say nothing and wink. But what I think it really is that many newspaper advice columnists in history were writers, reporters. For me, I was reporting about social trends, and I started this column at a time that Facebook had not long been public for non-college students. People were finally online dating, you know, without being ashamed of it. So I was writing all of these pieces about how we're texting instead of calling. It all sounds very dated now, but I eased into this because I started having opinions about these things and perhaps always had. So, you know, advice columnists, which I'm sure Jessica can tell you, is that we all don't have it together necessarily in our personal lives and don't have all of the degrees all of the time. But we tend to be the kind of reporters and writers who watch.
Jessica, we'll talk more about some of your specific instances when we come back from break. But I do want to ask, as you sketched out some of the early figures in advice columns and advice giving in this country, a couple things struck me. One was that you're talking basically about men. And the mm-hmm. second thing that struck me was that it seemed as though they were utterly divorced from any level of engagement with these issues themselves. How much expertise did these folks who sort of set the industry going have?
Oh, they would say a lot. I think that when the first advice columnists were all men, and they were all, as you said, very removed from the problems that they were trying to help people solve. And I think what you see over time is that people sort of preferring vulnerability over expertise. And though I think to answer the caller's question, there are advice columnists out there with specific expertise. But I think that a lot of the advice columnists I focus on in my book are sort of more interested in creating a space where people are able and willing to be vulnerable. And one of the examples I include in the book is a woman named Sylvia Porter, who was an incredible expert on financial matters. Mm-hmm. But she actually sort of shied away from that later in her career because she felt like it was making her less approachable to her audience. And I think that's expertise has been a struggle for a lot of advice givers over the decades because they need to present as someone who people can talk to. And it's if you're too much of an expert, I think they found that people sort of retreated from that.
And was there a sense, I don't have too much time, but was there a sense that because Porter was female that somehow expertise was off-putting?
Absolutely. And that's a big theme of the book. I think that a lot of the advice columns that gave women an opportunity to have a column and to have a national platform. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they had to shy away from presenting too much as experts in order to maintain their likability, which, of course, is a struggle a lot of women in public have today.
Jessica Weisberg, Meredith Goldstein, stay with us for the full hour. We're discussing the history of advice columnists and lessons for the present day. You can join the conversation. We hope you will. What do you hope to get from the advice columns you consume? Where do you turn for advice? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about advice columns, why America loves them, what we're hoping to get out of them. You can join the conversation. Are these columnists and postings and podcasts just a placeholder when we should be seeking therapy? Is it easier to pour your heart out anonymously to a trusted face in the newspaper? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Boston Globe Love Letters columnist Meredith Goldstein, who's out with a new memoir called Can't Help Myself, Lessons and Confessions from a Modern Advice Columnist, as well as Jessica Weisberg, who's just written a new book titled Asking for a Friend, Three Centuries of Advice on Life, Love, Money, and Other Burning Questions from a Nation Obsessed. You know, I got to confess, even as a dude, growing up, you know, I certainly consumed a decent amount of advice columns. I would be in the backseat of my car. My mom would drive around. We weren't listening to the ball game. We'd listen in Southern California to Dr. Tony Grant on KABC Radio. As a young adult, I'd consume Carolyn Hacks and Dear Prudy and Slate. And yet, when you go back into the annals, into time, Jessica Weisberg, we found in the pages of your book an astonishing array of figures who are offering advice, some of whom you might not have thought of in those terms. Ben Franklin not only telling us early to bed and early to rise makes us healthy, wealthy, and wise, but telling us a lot of other things, some of them based on the stars. What were some of the things you found out about some of the historic figures that you incorporated into the book?
Well, I think what really interested me about some of the historical figures in the book was just how there was a huge interest in advice from many leaders in America very early on. Like George Washington wrote an etiquette book. Benjamin Franklin obviously wrote Poor Richard's Almanac, which, for those who aren't familiar with it, was a regular sort of compendium of one-liners, sort of like early to rise makes a man healthy, ready and wise. And the idea for Benjamin Franklin was that he wasn't just looking to help individual readers, as sort of contemporary advice columnists often are today. He really wanted to influence America. He talked about how he hoped that the book would sort of make the American economy run better and make people in general sort of kinder and more productive and wiser. And I think what interested me looking at the figures throughout my book is that advice columnists are an idealistic bunch, and they were looking not just to help better the lives of the individuals who are reading them, but to better the whole society.
And yet some of the stuff that they're advising, you know, Franklin was doing stuff on astrology. You have the gentleman who promoted, if I'm not mistaken, the graham cracker, suggesting very cold baths and almost no sex. You had some things that, in common parlance, what we'd say, that one didn't hold up, right?
Yeah.
That didn't wear
well.
There's some
very strange advice in the book. There's a dieting expert named William Alcott who advises never to eat tomatoes under any circumstances.
Sure.
Very bad for you, which clearly has not quite panned out. Not all the advice is great in this book. But I think what it does do, and as Meredith alluded to earlier very smartly, is that it really provides a window into what life was like in the past in history. Because I sort of see the book as sort of an emotional history of America. And you can see what people are worried about and how that's changed over time and how it stayed the same. And dieting is one of those things that's caused Americans a lot of anxiety for many, many centuries.
So we have a caller from Miami, Florida, Alana, I believe it is. Alana, go ahead.
Hi, David. So I was listening, and what really made me laugh is that I read a lot of Reddit. Reddit has a relationship advice section where you can post a question and people on the internet will answer it for you.
How do you get that? Or put it this way, what do you get from that?
Oh, I read it for entertainment purely. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think it's cool that – sorry, my navigation is on. I think it's cool that you can ask people, random strangers on the internet, and if they have any – if they relate to your question at all, they offer the best advice that they can. And sometimes it's pretty good advice.
And so people seeking a path forward in life as well as on the road in Miami, Florida. Alana, thanks for your question. As we are finding new platforms in which people seek advice, Meredith, how has the nature of the kinds of questions that people face changed?
Well, I mean, I think she points to a great point in general, which is that now that advice columnists are living online, we're hearing from an entire community of people. It's never just the advice columnist. And for me, when I started the column, I wanted a zillion commenters to tell me if I'm wrong or right. And that's not something that you used to be able to do. But, you know, in terms of the evolution of those problems, you know, some of these questions are timeless. But then some of them, you know, I can tell you the first time I saw the word Snapchat in a letter. Now I get letters all the time about Snapchat. This is not something I thought would happen, right? So I think we are all looking to each other to say, how do we use these new technologies? How do they affect our lives? It's not easy.
We've got a nice example from your podcast in the debut episode of your Love Letters podcast for the Globe. Meredith Goldstein talked with a woman named Sam. She baked a college boyfriend a cake and wrote him a long, thoughtful love card the night before Valentine's Day. And then something happened you wouldn't have had in the era before iPhones. He stood her up and he texted her the next afternoon saying, "Sorry, I've been a bad boy last night." Meredith picks up the story from here on the podcast.
If you're guessing at what he meant by bad boy, you would be correct. So the night that I was baking him the cake and getting ready for Valentine's Day, he's with some broad cheating on me, and I'm home alone, like, sick as a dog, you know?
What were your first thoughts when you read that text?
You. I ate the cake. I think I burned the card, no joke, with, like, all my roommates and friends.
That sounds like a pretty honest reaction.
It's a colorful reaction,
It is a colorful reaction. It is an FCC unfriendly reaction, but we bleeped it there for your enjoyment and delectation. What do you get out of doing this on in a podcast form, that kind of give and take?
Well, it's interesting because I was in a room with her, and I never get the chance to sit in a room with letter writers and talk to them. Usually what happens is I will go to a wedding or somewhere out of town or, you know, be at a restaurant and someone will corner me and say, it was me 2 years ago. My boyfriend cheated on me, you know, but I never really get to have this back and forth. So it allowed me to, you know, it gives you the chance to ask follow-up questions, which is wonderful. And I've just been shocked at how many people, even on a podcast, are willing to disclose so much. And then you get to see the agony in their faces and it's that much more empathy.
Jessica, do you think that because people now share things online through Facebook, Instagram, and other places, that there's any difference to the way in which they're willing to share things now, sort of let it all hang out as they approach people like Meredith?
You know, I really think that it's remarkable how much it stayed the same.
Really?
Because I think what the internet allows is a level of anonymity. And if you go back to the earliest advice column, which was 1690, in that case, it was a man named John Dunton who started an advice column with his two brothers-in-law and a guy they were like 50% sure was a doctor. And they pretended they were like 24 wise men.
He finished half of med school?
No one was totally sure. And that they pretended they were 24 wise men and people, this was in London, and people from London just wrote in with all of these very, very heartfelt questions. And it was because there was anonymity, the anonymity on the part of the advice giver and the anonymity on the part of the advice receiver. And I think the internet just offers that same level of it's like a shrouded space where you don't have to be found out. And as you mentioned earlier, David, the advice columns really carry some shame. We still have some embarrassment about seeking advice. And I think the internet really lends itself well to being able to seek advice and not be found out. And I think the other thing that's really changed with the internet is it's given more people the opportunity to give advice, as the caller referred to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great because I think it gives people the opportunity to get advice from people whose experiences resemble their own.
We've got a call from Columbia, South Carolina. Christian is on the line. Christian, tell us your thoughts.
Well, thanks for taking my call, David. I love this topic because for some reason I always find myself in the position of an advice giver. I guess it's because my dad was a psychologist growing up. I guess my friends think I have an inside scoop to something. But I do keep a couple guidelines whenever they do come to me for advice. And usually what I tell my friends, in most cases, the least selfish solution is usually the right answer. just in general, or personal, you can always feel that you've done the right thing if you go by that rule when giving advice. And the second thing I always tell my friends is that they should never take advice from their friends. Usually, when you ask a friend for advice, they're too close. They'll, for example, if one of my friends is mad at her boyfriend. You know, usually a friend's going to say, oh, yeah, he's a big jerk. You're right. You should leave him. You should do this. Whereas someone who's a little further away from that environment will say, you know, how do you think he feels? What do you think his motivations are? You know, they'll help the communication process as opposed to just being a cheerleader.
So, you know, for the love of all you hold sacred, don't trust the people closest to you. Christian, thank you so much for your call. Great, great insights here. Meredith Goldstein, what do you make of that?
I mean, I love that concept because I do think many times I hear from letter writers who tell me, I haven't told my parents, I haven't told my friends, I haven't told my children, but I want to know from you and your readers. And there is an objectivity. You know, they're sharing the most important parts of their story and we don't have to project anything onto them or think about what they said last Christmas. It's they get to you know, choose their own narrative in that way. And I think there's something really beneficial to having a stranger take a fresh look.
I want to hear from a voice that both of you know well and that our listeners, probably a good percentage of them, know well. This is the voice of Esther Pauline Lederer, better known by her pen name Ann Landers. It's a clip from the public television show Day at Night in 1974. And she's talking about what motivated her and her responsibility as an advice columnist.
Here is an opportunity to really do some good in the world. If I could write an advice column that millions of people could read, just think of what I could tell them. I viewed it as an opportunity to educate people, to help people. You know, there are millions of people in this world who have nobody to teach them anything, no place to go with the problem. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could write a column that would go all over?
Now, Ann Landers, or Esther Pauline Lederer, was, of course, one of two twin sisters who famously wrote competing advice columns. What did you learn about her? What surprised you about her, Jessica Weisberg, as you wrote your book, Asking for a Friend, Three Centuries of Advice on Life, Love, Money, and Other Burning Questions?
I think what surprised me about both of the sisters is that they were giving advice for such a long time. And if you read their columns, you see how their ideas change over the decades they were giving advice, mm-hmm. and how being put in that position and being exposed to the troubles of the world made them more progressive over time and more open-minded and more sort of willing to sort of go with how the world was willing to move with the changes of the world. And when they started out, they were very socially conservative. They were against premarital sex, against birth control, against interracial marriage, against interfaith marriage. And then over time, you see them really changing their views. And what I found so interesting about that is I think they were really trying to provide a service, as that tape really shows. And I think to provide a service, their advice had to change and had to sort of reflect the changing norms of society. And Ann Landers and Dear Abby actually were both very progressive on gay rights. Mm-hmm. Like very early on, they thought they would advise parents to love their children no matter who they loved. And it was interesting to see them become more progressive on all matters of topics as time went on.
I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point. You know, Jessica Weisberg, to your point, in your chapter where you talk about the two of them, you write about a woman, or I guess a couple, who wrote in from Indiana after 1967 when the Supreme Court struck down laws prohibiting racial intermarriage in Loving versus Virginia. She wrote... She received a letter that said, "Our daughter, who is in law school, told us last night that she wants to announce her engagement to a black medical student. We are not prejudiced people, Anne. In fact, we are the most liberal people in our social circle. But having a black son-in-law is another matter." And Ann Landers wrote to Indiana parents that she sympathized with them. But, quote, "whether you like it or not, this is the direction in which the world is moving." Meredith Goldstein, you actually, if I'm not mistaken, befriended Ann Landers.
Well, I befriended her daughter, Margot Howard, who happens to live in town and is wonderful. And to be friends with an advice columnist when you are an advice columnist is a wonderful thing, because finally there's someone who can give you advice, right?
Sure.
So we've talked
a more ultimate authority.
Right, absolutely. And we've talked about one thing that I think is so incredible about Ann Landers. Well, one is that she was a very good reporter as well as advice giver. But also, when you think about all of the hundreds of thousands of people who took the time to handwrite a letter and put a stamp on it and mail it, I mean, this day and age, I get letters sent at 3 a.m. on a Saturday, mm-hmm. you know, from someone who's mad right now. And maybe on that Sunday morning, I get an email from the same person saying, "Actually, can I take that back? You know, I just slept on it." So I think about the thoughtfulness that went into both sides of her column, the people writing in and also her response.
Mm-hmm. What kind of advice did she give you when starting out about how to address it and how to think about your audience? What's held up for you?
You know, Margot, you know, I think...
You should explain. I mean, Ann Landers' daughter, Margot Howard, herself ended up being a very accomplished advice columnist.
Yeah, so Margot was a Dear Prudence. She also wrote Dear Margot. And she is a you know, just whip smart, hilarious person. And she is, we are fascinated by each other because she's been married four times and I'm like forever single. So the main thing we actually talk about is how the two of us give advice to anyone at all. But I think that's also a tradition of advice columnists that they don't always have it figured out in their personal lives. But, you know, I think she just sort of, I think we both talk about the level of empathy you need. And again, saying the thing that you would say in person. It's so important. You can't, if you were the columnist, you can't hide behind an avatar or a byline. You're talking to real people, so you have to treat it that way.
What else did you find about, you know, you talked about the idealism, Jessica, but you also reflected what seemed like a very intense competition between the two sisters. What kind of dynamic was revealed there?
Yeah, they were – so Ann Landers started her advice column first, and then for a while they were working on the column together. And then Ann Landers' editors, the Chicago Sun-Times, was uncomfortable with that because the letters were confidential and they didn't want anyone outside the paper reading them. Uh-huh. And then a few months later, Pauline started her advice column at the San Francisco Chronicle. So they were in direct competition with each other almost immediately.
Well, and you got to love that there are family dynamics even among the professionals. We're going to ask you both to stand by and stay with us. We're discussing the rich history of advice columns and why we're so obsessed with them. You can join the conversation. Do these columns help? Are we just asking someone else to do the hard work for us? Are we simply dwelling? Or are we actually learning something? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
It's not a secret. Parenting is hard. But maybe we shouldn't put so much pressure on ourselves.
To get to good outcomes, sometimes you do better by not worrying about outcomes at all.
I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of Hidden Brain. Join us as we explore two very different models of what it means to raise a human.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're tracing the history of advice columns, talking about how they've changed over time and what we can learn about ourselves. You can join the conversation. We hope you will. What role should these writers and podcasters and posters play in the Me Too era? What about manners and etiquette in the age of Trump? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with author Jessica Weisberg about her new book, Asking for a Friend, Three Centuries of Advice on Life, Love, Money, and Other Burning Questions from a Nation Obsessed, and the Boston Globe Love Letters columnist Meredith Goldstein. She's out with a new memoir called Can't Help Myself, Lessons and Confessions from a Modern Advice Columnist. Thanks you both for sticking here for the whole hour. You know, it was interesting. The early days and reflected in your book, Jessica, are about men, as you say. And yet there was an interesting insight that I think both of you have addressed at times about the role of men as people seeking advice. And there was something, I think, Meredith, you talked about our discomfort with straight men and sadness,
yes.
That a kind of reverse sexism. So we've gone from thinking about in the past kind of man advising, mansplaining, to men being in some ways held at bay. What did you mean by that?
So, you know, I noticed a trend over the years, and I've been doing this 9 years now, and this has not changed. If a man writes in, a straight man, sad about a breakup, let's say, the comment section is flooded with notes like, man up, you know, get out of bed, you're not allowed to feel this way, get over it. If a woman writes in, or a gay man for that matter, anyone but a straight man, and is sad, it's okay, but I'm always shocked that there is this discomfort, you know, with straight men showing any emotion. And I find this to be like super problematic for a number of reasons. But I think this is connected to a greater societal problem of, well, if you're not allowed to be sad, how do you process that emotion? So, you know, I talk about in the book how, you know, we'll get a letter from someone who will say, my girlfriend dumped me and I'm so miserable. And people will say, oh, man up, you know, this isn't a big deal. And then someone will realize in the comment section that the letter writer is in fact a woman writing about being broken up with by a woman. And the advice changes. Oh, well.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Oh, well, then, you know, take your time. You know, you have to grieve. Suddenly, the tone is very different. So it's one of there are so many things that have made me so much more optimistic about the world of romance and advice giving by doing this column. But that's one thing that has not changed for the better. So I'm hoping that over time it does.
Jessica, what's your sense about the role men have played, not as not necessarily as the writers, but as the people writing in, the people seeking advice or surveying what kinds of advice other people are getting?
Yeah, I think Meredith is right. I think that there is a lot of discrimination against men trying to be vulnerable in these spaces. And the advice columns that I looked at historically were often geared towards women and written by women in terms of the ones that were asking women to talk about their sadness at home and domestic issues and their love lives. It's more sort of the financial advice and the business advice that's more geared towards men throughout the 20th century, at least. And it's nice to know that that's starting to change in Meredith's column and in her comment section.
Jessica, in your book, you address a number of different kinds of advice, different kinds of help. It's not simply limited to romance and personal relationships. It's a whole suite of things. We have a clip here from one of the folks you touch on, Judith Martin, better known as Miss Manners, established at the Washington Post. At least that's where I first read her. I believe she started as a reporter there. After the 2016 election, she spoke to the Kansas City Star, and she's somebody who really talked about the need for certain kinds of decorum in personal interactions as well as public life. She said after the election that Americans need to remember good etiquette now more than ever.
There's a mistaken idea that etiquette suppresses conflict. And it's the opposite. It enables you to express it and to air conflict and to air your differences. If you are just calling people names and saying obscene things and yelling at one another, no ideas get expressed, nothing gets settled. That's not the way progress is made.
Now, having read a decent amount of Judith Martin and old dog-eared books at my parents' house, she's actually quite hilarious. But I got to say, the word etiquette suggests to me something stuffy and something staid and something from not only a different generation but several different generations ago. What role is there for etiquette in our society, and why was it important for you to explore that, given that the word, I think, for most adults now seems like something that's sort of quaint and distant?
Yeah, I agree. I have a lot of associations with the word etiquette, none of them especially good. And I think the word carries a lot of anxiety in terms of how one's supposed to act. And there's sort of a lot of class associations, which is why I think Miss Manners is such a great figure, because not only does she make etiquette approachable, but she also makes it about just people treating one another respectfully. And she comes from her father is a labor historian, and she talks a lot about etiquette as sort of treating workers with respect. And then in general, though, I would say that when I first started off writing this book, I, like many people, sort of bristled at the idea that there's someone who should tell me how to act and how to behave, and that there was one right way to do so. But I did a lot of much of this book was written during the election and during the early months of the Trump administration. And sort of like Ms. Martin says in the clip you just played, it became clear to me that basic respect and consideration for one another, which is just how she defines etiquette, was more important than ever and was being lost somehow. And that there were a lot of public figures who were saying very bigoted things in public, and that was not contributing at all to our public debate.
One of the things I love about Judith Martin back in the day when she was doing this was that there was sort of a surreptitious pragmatism to what she was doing. There was actually a hard-headedness and a humanity, as well as what seemed like a very prim thing. We've got a call now from Binghamton, New York, which also offers a different kind of pragmatism from another advice columnist. Amanda, tell us your recollection on this.
Well, this happened many years ago. It was one of the most memorable advices that I've ever read. It was, "Dear Abby, she gave a woman who called in and said her husband seemed more devoted to his mother than he was to her. And she complained to Abby about this and asked her husband if both she and her mother were both drowning, who he would save first. And he said that he would save his mother first because he owed her so much. So, dear Abby, what should I do?" And dear Abby wrote back, "Learn to swim."
Words to live by. Amanda, thanks so much for that memory and that call. I wonder, I don't think we can get through this hour without addressing in some ways the unspoken figure hovering behind all of this in the current day. You think about, you know, Oprah Winfrey, you know, in some ways the luxury mall of self-help. She not only had her own show for many years, she essentially brought to the forefront people like Mehmet Oz and certain kinds of alternative medicine, Dr. Phil, Susie Orman in finance. She's got fitness gurus and fashion guys and God knows what else. What role, Jessica Weisberg, do you see Oprah having played in our current thinking about not only getting self-help, but our need for it?
Well, I think we've talked a little bit already today about how needing advice, there's some shame to it. And none of us really want to be caught reading these advice books or these advice columns. And that was certainly true in the 20th century and certainly true for men over in the 20th century. And I think what Oprah has done is she's sort of made self-care and self-help more acceptable and has sort of opened it up to many more people.
So she's just – you're just saying she popularized it and she destigmatized it for those who thought somehow there was a stigma to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think?
I mean, I think for me, she also made it a lifestyle. Like, it's not just about having a problem and seeking an answer. It's how do we live, right? Oprah's going to tell me what to eat, how to eat it, what awesome sweater to wear, and then what book to read after I'm done. And I think what she did was, at least for me growing up, was to say that self-care is a part of a good life.
Mm-hmm. Does it bother you that some of the folks that she brings to us, you know, Mehmet Oz is, you know, one of the most distinguished cardiothoracic surgeons in New York, if not the East Coast. And yet some of the stuff he says online seems to be not in any way substantiated by science and research. Some of it, it seems to be, in fact, flatly contradicted by it. How should that affect how we look at that, Meredith Goldstein?
I mean, what's interesting is that Oprah brings in all these experts and the one person I trust is Oprah. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, you know, I don't always...
A former local news anchor.
Yeah, yes.
As opposed to some MD or something.
It's I want to know what Oprah wants me to do. And, you know, even as an advice columnist, the people she brings in, sometimes they say things that turn out not to be real or not helpful. But Oprah is the personality who is consistently helpful, I think, to so many of her fans.
Because she's opened this up to them.
Yeah, and because she's also willing to know what, you know, what she doesn't totally know. I mean, she'll do the research. She'll talk about her vulnerabilities, which I think speaks to what we spoke of earlier. What makes an advice column or advice giver successful is saying, what are we going to do about this? I don't quite know. Let's talk about it together.
We've got a call, I believe, from Savannah, Georgia. Ryan is on the line. Ryan, go ahead.
Hi, David. I just wanted to make the comment that I think that it's not necessarily the expertise of the advice giver that creates the pushback, but kind of a intellectual elitism. Because a lot of times advice columns give anecdotal information, and we know that that's not real objectivity, you know, and sometimes that can come across in an elite way. But I think these advice columns are also vulnerable to the fact that they're not really explaining to people that these things are anecdotal. I mean, you look at Dr. Oz, you look at fake news and the issues that we have with propaganda and things like that. We're not really helping to teach people how to identify the differences between these two things. And personally, I think it's great to have both sides, but I think that's the thing they're most guilty of, is not explaining the differences.
Meredith Goldstein, are we about to see a scourge of fake advice, flooding our social media? Are we not to trust what comes at us?
I mean, it does help in my column. There's no doctor in front of my name, right? So there's a real sense of what you're getting is a conversation. And I think that's where it gets confusing, when someone has a title, is a medical professional, and then we assume they know everything that's best for us. But I think, you know, the advice columns I read, you really do get the sense that this is a conversation, and you know, I'm signing my column with my first name. It certainly doesn't sound too – it's certainly not elitist, that's for sure.
I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. I wonder if I could turn to each of you and have a moment. We just do a lightning round. The single worst advice you've ever seen given. Meredith, you first.
I think I hear a lot, say yes to everything, to single people. Like, say yes. If you want to meet somebody, say yes to every, go to every party, go to, you know, never say no to an opportunity. And that is a quick way to get exhausted and not be open to meeting the right person.
How come?
I mean, I just think that everybody needs a moment to sit in front of the TV and to relax or whatever you do to unwind. And I think that, you know, right now,
Netflix and not chill.
Netflix and right. And by yourself. And I feel like right now, so many of my letter writers have dating fatigue because you can always be on an app. You could always be dating. You could be sifting through people right now. And I think that people are allowed to take a break. It shouldn't feel like a full-time job. So whenever I hear say yes to everything, you never know if your future spouse will be there. This is like advice I hear parents give their children. I think, wow, that sounds super exhausting.
And in the archives, Jessica, what did you find that just made you laugh out loud?
Well, this should make me laugh, but the worst advice I think that came up quite a bit in the book was just to never get divorced ever. And that was something Ann Landers and Dear Abby both said at various points. And that's something more contemporary advice givers have said that I profile in the book. And I disagree with that. I think that when I think people know when it's time to split up.
We have a couple of calls here. I believe we could go to Gigi calling from Savannah, Georgia. Gigi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering why Dr. Joyce Brothers, who did start out as a professional, as a psychiatrist, hasn't been brought up, as well as in later years, Dr. Ruth Westheimer, who had a completely different approach, as well as the general question of why, how many advice columnists in the past and in the present eventually become more interested in becoming a celebrity and being celebrated rather than sticking to just giving advice.
Gigi, thanks for raising those names and raising that question. Jessica Weisberg, how does the cult of celebrity and the cult of fame, particularly in the media, affect the kinds of people and personalities that we see dominate and the kind of advice they offer?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's tricky because I think advice givers, they need their audience to trust them. And obviously having a familiar name garners a degree of trust. And then if it goes too far and people feel like they're only giving advice to sort of promote themselves, people become more suspicious. And, before I wrote this book, I was sort of struck by the fact that a lot of the narratives about advice givers really approach these figures as really suspicious figures. Like Miss Lonely Hearts, the book by Nathaniel West, mm-hmm. really approaches an advice giver as a fraud. And I thought that was interesting because I think it really goes to that point that, like, our advice givers really just doing this for their own fame. And I think what I found is that, I think that advice givers have a lot of power in our society because they're willing to answer questions that a lot of people aren't willing to answer. And so it sort of comes with a degree of fame. And then how people want to embrace that fame is sort of up to the individual advice giver. But it's hard to come up with clear answers to questions about love and death and mourning and money. And if you're sort of willing to put yourself out there, I think it makes sense that you would sort of become famous through that.
Briefly, in less than a minute, the time we have left, you've been, Meredith Goldstein, a columnist on these matters for almost a decade.
Yeah.
What have you gotten out of it that you didn't expect?
I think the optimism, and I think Jessica pointed to that, which is that starting this column during a breakup, I thought this would only make me more miserable, hearing about people's problems all day. And instead, I feel like everybody's so thoughtful about their lives, and it makes me feel, I don't know, kind of like sappy that love is possible and all that stuff, because they all want it.
That's Meredith Goldstein, author of Can't Help Myself, Lessons and Confessions from a Modern Advice Columnist. Thanks so much for coming into the studio today.
Thank you for having me.
And Jessica Weisberg, she's author of the new book, Asking for a Friend, 3 Centuries of Advice on Life, Love, Money, and Other Burning Questions from a Nation Obsessed. Delighted to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.